Channel 1 over, and a continuation of the visit with Wade, with Rick and Suzanne, this Monday afternoon, 17th of July, 72. Channel 1 over, and a continuation of the visit with Wade, with Suzanne and Rick. Faye didn't sit in with us this Monday afternoon, the 17th of July, 72. Channel 1 over, and continuation visit with Wade, with Suzanne and Rick, this Monday afternoon, the 17th of July, 72. Channel 1 over, and a continuation visit with Wade, with Suzanne and Rick, this Monday afternoon, the 17th of July, 72.
And we get the discount. So it's a car. Mechanic. Sure, stop mechanic, and he gives me the discount. Or I just won't say anything, and he gives it to me. But as far as I know, plugs out there at any department store are fine. I stay away from some of the equipment because you can just look at it and see it's cheap.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I was just thinking about
if it's Champion or AC, I'm not rebuilt to my knowledge.
I was thinking about the mindset that these particular kind of characters have.
One experience,
you know, and they can add things up. But good Lord, to get them to explore some route, some avenue down here, man, they damn sure won't do it. You know, you tell them you got plugs here, and no way those plugs will work. They're going to explode when you put them in your car.
Now you told Buster and Charlie,
and they together broke out laughing and looked at each other, and I sort of stepped back and said, "What's wrong?" You know. I thought I'd been caught with something, and I had inferior product. They knew it, too. I want to find out bad, guy. I want to find out so bad, show them they're wrong.
Well, let me tell you, these batteries, you pick them up at the parts places, white battery and oil, you might save $5. But I found out through Cookie that he can pick them up and get them for half. He can get a good Delco battery that cost me $25. He can get it for 12 and a half.
I'll be damned.
Yes. I don't know where he gets it. But I mean, he gets it at regular places. He won't get it at White Electric. And I didn't realize on something like a battery, there'd be such a markup. Well, that's just phenomenal.
The markup on things are phenomenal on these kind of
they
products.
They just double it.
Well, I know a friend of mine
double it to start with.
Yeah. A friend of mine does the wholesale selling of nuts and bolts to the people that keep bins of nuts and bolts around.
Yeah.
You know, State Departments.
Supply cars.
Kind of things. And then retail outfits. He gets, good God, just for selling, he gets 20-something or 25 or 30%. You know,
yeah.
Just for his sales part.
Yeah.
And then there's a jobber back of him.
Yeah.
And then there's a manufacturer back of him that gets
his
profit. And then when the person that he gives it to, then they double the cost.
Yeah.
That was what was interesting. That's what we were sort of talking about with Buster and Charles, and saying, you know, there's a tremendous amount of markup on these things. And then I came in with that thing about those plugs, but man, they wouldn't allow it to be. They had agreed first that, sure, they marked these things up tremendously. But since I'd gotten them out there for 46 cents, it wasn't right.
You see, one thing that happened with Buster, it got so I can't deal with him. He won't go ahead and get it done. He'll keep it a week.
Don't feel unusual about that.
I say, Buster, I'm going right by White Electric, wherever you want to get these things. I'm going to town. I'll get it for you. He says, I'm going right by there.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not, and he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It'll take him a day or two. And he really plays that up close, you see.
He will not get a part until he absolutely needs that part. And then he pulls that old door shut. It takes a long time to get it shut, locks it up, gets in his car, and he'll drive in for one part.
One part.
Yeah.
it's part of his existence to do that.
Yeah.
And then generally he'll have a story to tell you when he gets back. You know, watching girls or something, going through town.
Yeah. Now there for a while, and he'd telephone in, and Frank Weaver would bring the part out to him whenever he thought about it.
Yeah.
But wasn't as certainty about it.
No, he is totally uncertain, and he will not replace something unless it's sort of not there. If there's any possibility of that thing being there and he can reuse it, he's going to reuse it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We got him to fix Beverly's brakes. It was 3 times back, and it still don't work right.
Yeah.
And I'm just do it myself, try to get it going right. Because he just didn't replace some of the things. But then you have to take it back and have it replaced. And say, oh, well, that didn't work. So.
Oh, that's odd, because usually it's the other way around. Everything they can get their hands on.
Wait, let me tell you. You and Buster and Sugar Man. Sugar Man's there and visits with Buster a good bit.
Yes, yes.
Now, when I woke up, Sugar Man cuts off. But you can... He'll keep on talking with you.
Oh, yeah, Sugar Man will carry on. I just sort of wander in. They don't pay attention to me.
Yeah.
I was trying to... We had a good time on the bench yesterday. Saturday it was. I went down to do some work in the office and never got in there. I was going to do some writing. And it was Buster and Jack and Jack Sanders and Jack Heron. And Heron's old woman, Marge, and a lady named Miriam, who used to be married to a man named Hutch, who was a war derelict and stayed drunk all the time in Micanopy.
Now, who was that?
Hutch. I don't know the last name.
A man?
The man's name was Hutch. He was a white-headed fellow.
Yeah.
He used to sit around Buster's all the time drunk. You know, hardly could walk.
Oh.
If he could at all. And he's on VA pension. And she's just a pleasant woman as you can imagine. She doesn't look or act or anything like she belonged with Jack Heron and Buster and Jack Sanders. I mean, that's a righteous crew.
You mean Hutch's?
Hutch's wife. He died, see.
Yeah.
And she came back to visit. She lives down around Lake Wales or somewhere like that, and works in a department store, and has a nice little lakefront house. And so they were all sitting out there on the bench, and so I sat down with them for a minute, and then they brought up the subject of beer. So they all agreed that since Jack Sanders was broke, we ought to flip to see who's going to get the beer. So we odd manned out till we got down to me and Jack Heron, and Jack says, "Okay, you call it." And I said, "Okay, Jack, just like you." And I always would have thought that meant that if I just like him, then I won. So I was just like him. He says, "Okay, buy the beer." And it's something about me and gambling. I don't care what happens, but I'll always lose. It never fails. If I'm flipping for a penny, it just don't let me into gambling. It's horrible. I can play Beverly for chips or anything, and I wind up losing. And I know I won that thing, but he conned me out of it. And I said, "Man, that's not right." He says, "All right, let's do it again." So he did it again, and did it according to my rules, and of course I lost that time, so I had to buy the beer. I wound up buying 4 six-packs of beer for those guys. I got 4 out of it, so I reckon $1 and something of beer in 2 packs for good company.
That's cheap for me.
Yeah. But Jack Heron and Marge, they were in rare form. There were these 2 young girls was sitting up in front of the gallery, see, and we're sitting down in front of Buster's on the bench, and Marge is there, and she was pretty well looped by that time, so was Jack, and Buster was doing some caterwauling at these girls up there, trying to get them down, and asking Jack if he'd seen them. Now, these girls are about 16, 17 years old, and Jack was listening a little bit, and next thing you know, gets up and gets in his car and drives down the road in front of the museum, goes down there, turns around, drives back. parks it and gets out. And what did he do? Just went and looked at the girls. Jack Heron. You seen him yet?
I don't think so.
Ooh, good Lord. He's well over 50, but he's got a lot of miles. I mean, he's got about 95 or 100 years miles on him at least. And he's got the teeth. Like one of them go out this way, and one down here, and one sort of greenish purple, and the other brownish yellow. You know, and always got a 3-day growth of beard. And he's about as handsome a cutter as you'd want to see. And his old lady Marge has got one glass eye.
Oh, he. Yeah.
I think I told you some stories about him across the street.
Picked her up or something.
Yeah, on 75.
Yeah, had to run so there, back town get her eye one time.
Yeah. Yeah, they're a beauty. And when she gets a little bit drunk, the eyes really get in good shape. Because evidently you can somewhat control that glass eye. When she gets drunk, they really get askew. I mean, just all kinds of angles go on. It's really amazing. I mean, you have to look 8 times to make sure you're looking in the right direction when she's talking to you. So anyhow, he gets cranking on these kids, and finally Jack Sanders goes up there and cons these kids into coming down to that little shop that's under my place, but they never do come down in front of the bench. So Jack Heron finally gets up, and he goes and walks in the shop. Well, there's Marge sitting there, and she starts fuming and fussing, and she's getting horribly upset because Jack's in there, Papa, she calls him. Papa's in there messing with those girls.
And he calls her Mama.
He calls her Mama. So she drags him out of there, but before she gets through yelling at him, she doesn't really get good into this thing about him messing around with those girls before Bill Preston comes out. Well, they've had this history thing going. See, Bill Preston and Jack grew up together. And they played together as kids and everything like that. And they knew each other. And I think I told you that long conversation I had with Bill Preston talking about when you knew those oak trees. When they were this high, and that this arm was the arm his own Arm and Hammer soda box,
yeah.
And that's Bill Preston. And he is a big scutter. I mean, he does have a big neck, and Jack's hardly there at all. He's just a fly on, he's as skinny as a rail. But I wouldn't want to mess with him directly if I got him mad, anyhow, Jack. But some time ago, about 2 months or 3 months, now, see, Bill told me his side of the story. Moaning, he was drunk, good Lord, and he was blubbering and moaning about how he really didn't want to do it, but he had to do it because Jack Heron kept asking for it, and he really shouldn't have done it because he's a professional boxer and it was a lethal weapon to hit somebody, and that was a horrible thing, and he wished he'd never been a professional boxer so he could hit somebody when he wanted to. I mean, he was full of complaints. he was crying about every aspect of that thing. But he says, I love Jack and I, but I just had to do it. I had to hit him. He kept asking for it. Well, a story I got yesterday was that they were drinking down at Weaver's, and Bill went home and asked Jack to come on down there and see him. So Jack came down there, and Jack was drunk. And I don't think Bill was quite drunk then. Jack drove up in his car, and Bill reached in and grabbed him, pulled him out, and beat the hell out of him. Before he could even open the door, see?
Oh.
And Jack was really beat up and too drunk to do anything about it. So the feud's on. Okay. And I didn't really know the feud was on. I thought that had been a settled proposition. So Jack came back down there in front of Buster's, and Marge was chiding him about the teenage girls. And then all of a sudden I heard Marge say, "Is now the time, Jack? Now the time, Papa? You going to do it now, Papa?" And I looked around, here came Bill. And so he walked over like that, sort of close, not within 8 feet of him, started across the street, and Jack says, "Bill, you ready now?" And Bill sort of sheepishly just walks on, he says, "Nope." He walks on across the street, you know, he's just sheepish as he can be. He sort of gets, and Marge, she says, "Oh, God, you should have heard the language she's using at Bill." And she says, "By God, I'm not going to leave him." And he can go, "I'll catch him." So she runs back of the car and starts to catch him. And Jack says, "No, no, let him go, let him go. That's all right, just let him go." And she comes out and says, "God damn it, I'll beat up Betty Joe then. That's what I'll do. I'll beat up Betty Joe. That's what I'll do." So she's getting in there and she's going to beat up his wife. And Jack says, "Well, that's the last time. Next time is going to be it." So evidently, he's been challenging Bill Preston each time. And Bill just says no and walks off. And Jack swears now the next time is going to be it. No, Marty's standing there calling him chicken shit. She wants the fight to go on. I mean, it was a hell of a circus.
All that on those beers.
Yeah. It was some more circus that went on there. And all the time, this Miriam girl is there, lady, and she's just so proper and nice, you know. I mean, she's Miss Sales Lady that you run into at Moss Brothers. You know, nicely dressed. She's got a brand new car with 800 miles on it, sitting right in the middle of all this. And then she turns around and invites everybody down to her place for a party, down at Lake Cottage.
Down
wherever in the world it is, Lake Wells or somewhere, wants a Bick and Opie to come down to her place for a party.
That crowd.
Yeah.
I never heard that Jack was that scrappy. He might talk a lot, but... Well,
I don't know how he can fight.
Yes.
I don't know really. But
well, you know, he's just in pieces.
Yeah.
He got shot out in the war. Yeah.
I think the major part of that, he's one of those characters that just doesn't give a damn. Now, see, you don't have to be able to fight if you don't give a damn. I mean, they'll wade into you. You know, and just be a little bit mean and not give a damn, you can cause a lot of trouble. You might get beat up, but that doesn't make any difference. just boom, right on in. And he really doesn't care. He just doesn't care.
And Marty doesn't either.
Oh, no. And they're such a beautiful couple. Last Saturday, they were bloody all over the place. I thought Margie got the worst end of the stick. She got beat up twice. But she was very straight... quick to inform me yesterday or Saturday that by God that Jack got his too. I sort of mentioned something about it, and man, she let me know right away he got his too. That wasn't any one-way proposition. And everything's just fine. Loves it. Just loves it. They owed Phil Chris some money Saturday morning, about 10 or 11 o'clock. Jack asked me where Phil Chris lived, because he'd been sick, see, and I told him where he lived. So Jack says, "Well, I know he needs some money. I'll go take it in." Jack's real good about that. You know, he didn't have to do that. But he'll try to pay up if he owes. And so I went by Phil's to see him, see how well he was, about 1 o'clock, 12:31, and he said, "Marge had just left shortly before that, and she came in, and blood was pouring down her face, and the money was all bloody. Wanted to know what had happened." I didn't know, because when it all transpired, they'd really gotten into it. And they do fight. They love it. Good Lord. That was a funny scene. All together.
And Jack picked her up on
75. And it just appears like it's really, really strong love. The only thing I can see. It's meant for each other.
You know, that's a possibility. You know, Don McKay down here. He is no count, no good. I used to hang around him a whole lot. Never had any money. And that's what he'd do. He'd pick up these hitchhikers on 441. And promise them a few things. he made me have food for him. And he got a lot of work done. Oh. Sometimes they'd stick around with him for a week or two.
You just work for him?
Yeah.
Is this male and female? Or what?
No, these were just four men that
yeah,
I know of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just the itinerants.
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't a Catholic. He was a naturalist,
mm-hmm.
and pretty straight, except he's improvident.
Put it nicely.
But those itinerants now you see on 75, that's a possibility.
Oh, I picked up a few. You can tell them right off how they. They start in on you, and generally they try to put a touch on you, and then you try to ask them where they're going, and
yeah.
It's not quite for sure. There's a place they've got to get to for some reason, but they're not too positive about why it is. They got to be there. they try to have a destination in mind, and some reason for being where they are, and it just so happens that somebody stole everything they had the night before. One guy tried to trade me a coat for $1, 50 cents or something. He said, this is all I got left, man. I don't want to bum from anybody. I just want to pay my way. He said, here's a coat.
Yeah. Now, you see, what you do, everybody gets something different. Now, Wade's view of Jack Heron is entirely different from mine, you see. But I don't get far with it. I used to, but you see, I've lost out with Buster and them now, and I don't get anywhere. When I had contact with him, he was through Buster, and I've lost out with Buster, and so I lost out with Jack too. But for there for a while, I was pretty close to him. But see, when I talked to him, it was all talk.
Mm-hmm.
And he stood up there and reported for an hour on what he did that day with his hammer up there, carpentry.
Oh, Lord, he'll do that, won't he?
Yes.
He'll give you every stick of it.
Oh, yes, he will.
How he got done in here and how well he did there and everybody else wasn't doing worth a damn and all that.
Yeah.
How many soffits he put in?
Yeah.
Evidently, he does work.
Well, yeah. But now you still haven't got a hold of McQuinney.
No, I've got to sort of make a point to do that.
Yeah.
Because, I saw dog Alfie drove by
yeah.
today, and his wife, and I think it must have been Ms. McQuinney. I didn't catch it because I was sitting... or either standing out front, just briefly, and I wasn't paying any attention.
Yeah.
I saw it was a garbage truck. It came by. It's a brand new, low-slung, stake-body truck. And I wish I'd looked a lot closer because what I saw was just sheer pride. They were all cocked back in the seat, and that thing was loaded down with garbage, man. They just looked over and smiled.
Low-slung?
Yes.
I thought they had a high-slung. Right?
Well, they got a brand new one. Just first time I've seen it. Brand new one.
Yes.
I mean, it's a new machine. And it evidently, Alfie took over the garbage thing, and he probably bought it.
Oh, Alfie.
Yeah, his son.
Yeah. So, is Daddy still has that high school one?
I don't know. I don't know whether we traded it or whether Alfie went and bought this himself and quit the state road department or what's going on, but they sure were proud. I'm telling you. And driving it down, it had a hell of a load on it.
Yeah.
That's just a glimpse of them as they went by. But I know it was there. I don't think I put that into them. He's funny. We got that little tractor, with all, you know, the little Cub tractor with all the hydraulic equipment on it. Just loaded down. You know, the thing isn't as big as this table.
No, but they're long.
We got the hydraulic back lifts and backhoe and plows, all these machinery, He'd drive it around Micanopy.
Now, who's that?
Alfie. Yeah. I don't know what cause he had for doing it, but he'd just take it out for a spin. With a lot of times, a lot of equipment on it. He'd stop by and want to know if you wanted any work done with the tractor.
We had a session with Patterson Burnett. Thank you, Sawyer. Oh man, he's a roughneck.
Now that's
school bus.
Oh yeah. Oh, I right enjoyed him.
Huh?
I that's the one I talked to out here, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Patterson.
Yeah. But you don't associate with him over there.
No, that's the first time I'd ever talked to him.
Yeah.
Oh, he's sure got some history around here, I'll tell you that. Talking about leaving at 4 a.m. to go shopping in Gainesville and getting back 4 a.m. That's just 24 hours.
He told you that?
Yes, 24 hours. Go to town. And you really want to go to town. You're going to take 24 hours to do it. That was when they didn't have any roads, and they had to go way around, and it was by horse and buggy.
Oh, yeah.
And he said they had a horse that would just move out. They couldn't keep it down. I don't know whether he's talking about the same. Oh, he was telling me stories about how he used to take his girl out with this horse that would move out. And show off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that right?
He'd get up on one of those two-wheel trotters and go get his girl, and that horse would just move along.
Yeah.
He was really, you couldn't hold the horse down. It would just move. He was right proud of that horse.
Now, you didn't bring your little Emerson. Now, you haven't got one.
No? You mean the circles thing I was talking about, or what? I bought that other book, Bit to Dust, my pocketbook, and I have yet to get one and get it outlined in. I still have it, but it's almost a non-usable state.
Yeah.
But,
I need to run through those things again. And I've been reading this little book on Emerson, and all my interpretation is wrong. You see, all his eye is always a transcendental eye, and I always left it out. Now, you see, what I have found is, you see, that Emerson would do this, and then the others would follow him. I mean, the student, professor. That transcendental eye. Where would you find that, Suzanne? When he talks about in self-reliance at the first part.
Yeah, or the, let's see, how's it go? Self-reliance. It gets off so that what he's talking about is not, well, the individual can trust his perceptions not because they're his, but because they're based on a sort of a transcendental intelligence that he's part of, and that's why he can trust him.
That's right. And now what you have to do, you see, he had read so much, he couldn't just make a psychological thing and talk about the perceptions that a person would have. I don't know whether he uses perceptions. He uses intuitions.
Intuitions.
He may use perceptions somewhere
else. He doesn't ever use it
in
like eyesight and touch and all. It's always the intuition, I think, really.
And he uses a number of words, you see, like glimpses and goes across the mind. Well, you see, he couldn't cut through that. It was too strong. He was brought up in it, you see, and all his reading was in, so much of his reading led him into that. Coleridge would even lead him into it, you see. And so now this will work on your article too, with the Reverend Campbell in the Life magazine. You see that transcendental eye. You see the word transcendental has no particular meaning. It's just a term that was used in connection with German philosophy. Well, it's the same thing as saying a theological eye or a religious eye, except that makes it too simple. You can use it, a philosophical eye, if you want to, and call it mystical. But I think the simplest way of handling it is that he can't make it just purely psychological. I wouldn't want to make it purely psychological either, not purely, but basically psychological. But he has to have, at least a good part of the time, he has to have a transcendental view of it. Well, if you use it, you've got to discard that. Now, what you've got to do, what I have found is, and this is very hard, it's just as hard for the mature people to do as it is for the younger people to do. When you get into a term that you don't quite get a hold of, you got to wrestle with it and cut it down to size.
Oh, yeah.
You may be wrong, but you've got to put it in terms that you can handle, or else you're lost. It's better to be wrong than lost.
Absolutely, yes. I have a favorite term that I worked myself to death on. It's a term called entropy.
Yes.
And I read that and studied it and made it mine.
Yes.
You know, and I've seen variations on what I understand about it, but I can use that term like that, and it means something to me, and it's not flabby. You know, it could be absolutely wrong, but I mean, when I use it, it's a... And I remember that, so I mean, the idea of just exactly what you're talking about, coming to grips with a term, because I kept looking at that thing and reading it. It wasn't
well,
easy.
You say you're not reading Emerson. Well, you know, you're not. You're just making something of him, actually. And you're not wasting your time. Now,
I just wrote a small short paper on that, on the reading, after coming to grips with this a little bit in circles, reading it two or three times. I really hadn't studied it at all, and it's right interesting thing. I don't know whether you appreciate it or not, but this guy Borges, I think I've mentioned to you before, speaks somewhat in similar terms as Emerson would talk in circles, essay, and regarding, there was a basic theme of circularity, which has to do, I suppose, with this transcendental eye. It's always moving, always coming around, things are always completely changing, so that one day you'd look at things differently from what you would the day before because of motion and circularity involved in it. But Borges speaks in short stories, and you can read these sort of Poe short stories, in essence. Sometimes they're too powerful and you don't get anything from them. But at least you can read the short story and be pleased somewhat with the short story. Or you can try to see what the man's talking about, which is pretty strong at times. I mean, it's sort of one theme thing he works with, and that is circularity. That's his basic thematic approach. And I just really sort of connected that. But like Emerson always talks in that straight language. He never has talk. He doesn't carry on like a Faulkner thing or tell a story to get this thing across. He doesn't. He never connects directly with the world in which this talk is concerned.
No. Now on your circle, on your circularity, you see, I refuse to think in any such terms.
Uh huh.
if I get what the idea is, I'll just state it straight. That if one thing don't work, he can depend on something else. If his grand lie doesn't work, he can just use a psychological lie. Maybe that's what he means. I don't know. But I refuse to use pictures. And I don't want to have I don't have my mind nettled. You see, it's bad enough. It works poorly enough. You see, with just plain language.
The only reason I was
let me tell you, get back to your argument. Now, it's interesting, and you see this fellow Campbell. Now, what I'm going to do is just apply that same method to your article.
Okay.
I'm going to cut through it and get it to a place where you can use it. It looks more usable than it is, and I don't think it is usable. You see, he was with the civil rights movement from Little Rock on. He was a redneck himself, and they educated him, and he returned to work with the rednecks for the civil rights. Well, now you want to see what he sees in the rednecks or with the black people that he worked with. And you don't really see. You see that he sees them burn the crosses, and he can see the provocation that they have. You see, that would make them do that. And this last year, I spent trying to surface. With this stuff out here, trying to make some use of it and institutionalize it a little bit. And what I did, I abandoned the countryside. And I lived, you might say, amongst the bureaucrats. Now, in your article, you never see him amongst the rednecks. The man who writes about it has him amongst bureaucrats. You still don't know whether he can talk to the rednecks or not.
Aren't they, isn't there one or two descriptive passages?
Very small.
Yeah, very small.
Very small. And there he's interested in their soul.
Rather than the person.
So that his theology, he'll make a... Now, here's another little thing, you see. he dispenses pretty much with religion. But he makes one religious statement there, and it's from Paul. And any statement you get from Paul will knock the props out from under you. I mean, he's dangerous.
You started another institution when you quote from him.
Oh, yes, sir. Oh, yes, sir. And you see, the thing he does is that statement of Paul's, you see, that, what in the hell is it?
He forgives us our he holds our misdeeds not against us and reconciles.
Yeah, that reconciled. He reconciled. The Father, through Jesus, reconciled us, you see, and doesn't hold our misdeeds against us. Okay. That's the end of the, that jig is up. He's made a ready statement, and he's gonna change them. He's not gonna look at them. He's gonna change them.
As soon as he gets on that tack. Huh?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Well, as soon as he gets on it, he's on it all the time.
Yeah.
But it just comes out every now and then. Seemingly he's with the rednecks, but he's not. Now, what I saw, what that article helped me see is, You see, I have tried for a long time to work, get find somebody who'd work on with me, you see, on religious, making something out of it. Well, now what I saw of it in this is that, you see, the religious people make so many statements. You can't finish one statement before you got six others. And they use them on children. They'll make mature statements and feed them to the young. Way too young for them. So a religious statement is not something that enables you to see. It's something that changes. Now it says there, the reporter says that he had got past that. He didn't want to change them anymore. He'd take them as it were.
But you see it differently.
I don't know. I think he sees them a little bit, but I don't think he's much interested. You see, what I found out about the religious people is they're not really interested in the people. They're interested in changing them. And they couldn't report on Jack Herring the way you did. It'd simply be out of the question. You got no possible way. Now, and they use such big statements, you see. They use such big statements. So much bigger than the occasion requires. You know?
Yeah, his little, come think of his little ballads, I recall that. Change.
Yeah.
And the old fella saying, I'd be damned if I'm going to die with any niggers or something like that.
Yeah,
go to heaven with
all
niggers.
Folks when we die.
Yeah. Well, you see that.
Or that's time enough for me, not now or something.
Yeah. Well, you see that's on the line, and he's not really looking at him. He's looking at him in that text. In terms of that text.
There's a thing that my brother-in-law went through. You want to go ahead?
See, I was brought up with rednecks, and I'm close to them. I like them. And I don't want to save them or change them.
Good Lord, who'd want to change Jack Sanders?
Yeah.
I mean, it gets to be questionable when you start talking about changing Jack Sanders.
Yeah.
Highly questionable. You just get in trouble if you do.
Now, that's not the last word on it, but that's as far as I can go. And I wouldn't want to be negative about it, but I'd want to guard against it. So that you think you've got something in this, but you haven't.
I would.
Now, you see, you've got the same thing in Emerson. Emerson makes actually a religious statement. But I never take it in that term.
Mm-hmm.
And I've used it since I was an adult almost. But it's not in his sense. So I took Emerson in the terms in which I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least in the way in which I could use him. Now, I found out, you never exactly know him. I never know exactly what happened. Jack Long wrote me, and he says, the trouble with you is, you've been bitten by Thoreau and you've never recovered from it. But Thoreau didn't bite me very hard. I have done a good bit of that same thing that Thoreau did. But the heart of Thoreau, of looking at things, but the heart of Thoreau I never did. I never lived a day, and he dies. That's never entered my mind, comfort or proper day, as Emerson said, following him. That was never part of it. So, I observed the wildlife good bit, Cicero, for a while. And I learned from that I could just go outdoors with a pair of binoculars and nothing was happening, and I could stand there 5 minutes and something, you'd have a circus going on. I could see. Now, I can do that now with people. But I learned it through the road. I didn't care it over them. I could do that. You just watch and things will happen.
Seems that way.
With the world outside, not people. Now, Emerson, I think, I'm not absolutely sure of what it is that Emerson has, but for one thing, he has a presence that I find less satisfying. And he's an orator, he's a rhetorician, he speaks a language, and some passages are just beautiful. Just marvelous.
He lifts you. He can lift you.
He can lift you without the content.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He talks about the inspire thing, and he does it.
Yeah.
He talks about it. He does it very quickly.
Yeah.
He does it with me.
But you don't know what you've been inspired for. You're not really sure what he said there. It just makes you feel like you.
Yeah. Well, now he faces education as a scholar, and you have to make something out of that. And I'm not sure that is the thing that has been useful. For instance, that's what enabled me to get into a little Faulkner. That part of it, I could see Ike as a scholar. But I think the part that I hung on to the most, seemingly, apparently, was self-reliance. Where, you see, I take that beginning of self-reliance, that so far I've never seen anyone else do it. And I take it as the perceptions. And what the rest of it is to keep the perceptions alive. And society will kill them. Rick went down there to Miami, you see, and he down there a good while before we heard from him. And he sent back, I remember one of the little pieces that you did on the employment office. And it was such a dim light, with hardly any charge in it at all, and it seemed to me like it was just what you'd expect. You've got no mental life in Miami, or he wasn't connected with it.
It'd be hard to find it.
Yeah,
I know that.
It was almost miraculous, you see, to get that little lightning bug of a thing from down there. Well, now that's what society does to you. Unless you can cut through it, and you can't cut through it unless you've got fortitude, won't do it.
Those places like that will keep do you in after a while.
You're by yourself,
generally.
Yeah.
And finally, you get to overwork, get that workload broken on you.
Yes, you're gone.
Circuit breaks.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the things done me in on this business thing. I've had it, enjoyed it so long, but I can't contend with it anymore. Yeah.
I never did think of the nonconformity as being a nonconformist. It was a mental nonconformity. That is where you freed yourself from the institution. You could see that the institution was basically flat-headed. It freed you. It gave you a little freedom. And I've seen that happen since World War II, when people read that. They didn't know what was happening to them. But from them on out, they didn't fight the institution. They could take the dullest courses and not fight them. I saw that happen. I didn't know what was happening. I know that's what happened. And that's what Emerson helps you do. Now, that aggressive side of Emerson, where he says the word, you see, will is the powerful thing. I never. It's there, but I never pay attention to it. In other words, now this is the thing, you see, that these little books don't do, or don't know, or don't pay attention to. You see, Emerson is full time over a year, period of years, you see, since he, well, from the very beginning. It was an inquiry. And you see, he had direction. And the inquiry will go in so many directions. It's got so many prongs. Well, you take the countryside. If you look at those, you see the terms in which I see them are very interesting. If you look at them from the economic side, it's awful. Or these road workers, you see, they give you the creeps just to think about how they grade that road in the other countryside. Well, but I don't want to take the countryside in those terms. So I think you can choose the side as long as you don't kid yourself. Well, I can let the parts of Emerson go that I don't want. And, you see, I didn't realize just all the time just what was happening, you see. I wasn't even inquiring. I was just stumbling. I think the first direct inquiry I ever made was when I first came down here, and that was the summer Faye. Little Faye was here. We were out on the North 40, and I had to build a gate, and I just had to face it. I didn't know how to build a gate. So we started looking at gates. And that was my first deliberate inquiry. We saw one gate after another. And most of them were just pitiful excuses for gates. Just pitiful.
He's the cheap beaut. He buys a metal gate.
Well, but you see, Emerson did that from the very beginning. And he did it with such, you see, his aides, his helper, you see, he had to rely on such extraordinary people as Coleridge. No one can understand what Coleridge said. It's just not understandable. It's not open to the intellect. Some people will write books on him, but you don't understand the books. And that's what he had behind him, you see. And here's the thing, you see, Walden, Thoreau lived a pretty clear, he had a pretty clear mental life because he never read books. It's almost like Barbara said when she came back from school, she sold the books behind the bed. And it helped her. If you take them serious, you see, you get in trouble. Especially Emerson. And even now, you see, if you go to the psychology department and try to understand people or how their mind works, you're gone, Gosling. Because their mind don't work itself. You'd do better to go talk to somebody else. Now that's what you get into.
I learned that without even knowing about it, guy. I took 18 hours of that stuff and didn't know. I said, whoa.
Yeah.
That's there's nothing there.
Right.
I'm leaving.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Whew.
Now, I think what the thing, you see, Emerson sort of kept me alive, and I think the thing that I've learned from is that little thing that happened in the fall of 68. That was when Suzanne came down here, up here from, when she started up here, fall of 68. And that September, I told you about it, you know. I hadn't seen any of my friends. I go around and listen to them talk, and it was such beautiful talk, you see. And I just saw it. They were just on the brink. And I just couldn't hardly stand to hear them talk. That'd be the end of it. And I went around that about that middle of September, and I had that those little cassettes. And I made a cassette over with Mr. Patterson's, and one over with Mr. Gilbert's, and one over with Mr. Morrison's.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, I'm indebted to Mr. Morrison. And he, at that time, he was talking about Governor Wallace. I mean, that was his first real go-round with him. Now that is the first time you see, I liked the talk and all like that, but I couldn't handle it. I had no critical basis, no critical. I couldn't take hold of it. And that was the first time. And Eric Hoffer helped me make a statement. You see, so many things working together. And the first time I saw, you see, that what they did, all that talk was interesting. It was never trivial. They never quipped. It wasn't nervous talk. They didn't talk about what other people thought about them. And that's all the college talk. That's all the talk is on the campus. They don't talk about the subject matter. It's the most aimless sort of neurotic nervous talk, you see, that you get up there. That's all you get. That's all they know, you see. And they're nervous and they're addled and don't know it. That was, with great leisure and poise, all experience. And that's where the term experience came in. But there were several things contributing to it. See, I was pulled from so many directions. I carried that all fall. And I worked on it so hard, by Thanksgiving, I wrote it out. By Thanksgiving, when I wrote it out, I was just like a dish rag. I was completely worn out. The thing was pulled so hard. But that's what did it. And through them, I saw how to look at people. They could see people. They could talk about them. Nobody else could. So it's not Emerson, it's not all Thoreau that opened it up, or Melbourne. It's the countryside that opened it up for me. Now I transferred that to Melbourne. So I can see in Melville where he is using experience and where it's literary.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, this last trip, Suzanne, down here, we worked that out through Leon Howard, a little article in this book here. That little Hawthorne period, when he was close to Hawthorne and was writing Moby Dick.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you see, we can handle that now, and see what he does. And what he does in Ahab, you see, he's not very interesting as Melville works him out. He's Shakespearean. He's thinking of himself, you see, as Shakespearean. Then he has all these other ideas about Ahab, so that he's literary.
It's just, you see, literary. I never got back into that.
I mean, it's like he's never seen an Ahab.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of made up.
That's right.
The others he's seen.
It's Hawthorne in it. How did we get Hawthorne in it?
Oh, that was the blackness, and we tried to figure that out.
Yes.
Now, I know,
yes,
it was...
Yes, that blackness.
Hawthorne had the power that just simply hadn't been in the literature before.
Yeah.
There's that art.
Yeah.
In the sense of it.
He could feel Hawthorne's art. Fuel. And then instead of taking Hawthorne's heart, he took Hawthorne's blackness and transferred that to Ahab. So you see that it's a literary thing.
Mm-hmm.
But now Ishmael is not, at least the early Ishmael. I don't know what Ishmael becomes. I'm not much interested. The Ishmael I'm interested in is the one up to the quarterdeck. But then all through after the quarterdeck, you still get those beautiful sections, you see, of the gams and the sea lore, and the all of it is almost pure experience. And then he looks at whales, you see, just as clearly as Thoreau looks at red squirrel.
I never got too far in that at all. I never even studied that. But I was just thinking that you were possibly ahead of yourself, because the only thing that you really nailed down to me on it was the sermon.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's sort of a relationship of, I mean, he set it up, but it's the preacher, his relationship was directly with his people, talking to them straight in their language. And that was such a beautiful thing. I just love it.
Yeah, and there's no theology in it much.
My recollection of it is just the real caressing of the people, soulless to the people.
He thinks of Jonah, he reconstructs Jonah. And he makes him feverish, you see, like Ahab in his cabin. Well,
that's quite interesting, guy.
It's so, but you see, you have to fight. I am so slow. I have to fight every
inch of the way. I've been fed by various things for some time. I've been wanting to get into the Morning of Magicians with you. You talk about expiration. That's the thesis of the whole book. And he's made some of the finest statements in the beginning and the end. He has great concern with love, its power, its feeling of love. And that last page of his book is beauty. It's a piece of writing. It's a really good thing. But the whole thing is, he doesn't philosophize in this book at all. But the whole time, all he simply says is look about, look, observe. And he's talking about with the mind, eye and mind combination, that you do not see what is there. And what is there is not necessarily what you see. It's a really nicely done thing. But you can get lost in the specifics that he deals with.
Oh yes, you've got that 18th century sensational psychology of what the mind sees, you know. Whether or not it's there or not, well, that doesn't get you anywhere. Emerson got into that a good bit.
Yeah, he's not doing a lot of scientist type thing, and I don't think there are parts of it you wouldn't care for at all. But I think that last page is, and actually the first. So he starts it off with a statement about his stepfather and his coming to understanding his stepfather.
You know, what you do, you get into these books that take you all around the mulberry bush, and you don't have time to handle them.
Well, I've been with that book for 6 years. I hadn't been into too many more books. I read it when I started off. Somewhat connecting it. I mean, I read it from my experience with Emerson.
That's a noble idea. But I don't think you can handle a book by yourself. I can't. You see, now, on this article, I worked on that a good bit.
Mm-hmm.
And to start with, I couldn't see it at all. I couldn't see it. I didn't know what to look for. And, you see, actually, I didn't need to look at that. I mean, I need to do something else, but I kept that in my mind, you see, for a good while.
Well, I wasn't critical of that.
It's granted, well, you know, there's no use reading it unless you make some money.
Well, I was just the rhetoric of the, I was into the talk aspect of that, is it, all of it.
Well,
but
I
can see what you
passed reading for rhetoric.
Well, just a point of interest in the thing, is this connection with people.
Yes, but you can't get the connection. You see, it's very difficult. You see, you can't handle that theology of business. It's just like the transcendental eye, never. It'll throw you.